Well, if there's someone who epitomizes the here, there, and everywhere-ness of God's call into mission, then it'll be our guest on the couch this morning. Whether in New Zealand or in Pakistan or Afghanistan and Fiji, this person has lived a life which has been marked by incredible faithfulness to God and his call. And she is a friend and an incredible inspiration to me personally. So would you join me in welcoming Margie to the couch? And can I just ask, just to clarify with this bingo stuff, because Julie put it out like a poll to the family Facebook page, and people said random noise was one of, is random noise a word, or do you want me to make a random noise? I'm just trying to clarify it for people. This is just, oh man. Okay, I'm really sorry in advance if something ends up being randomly offensive. Just.
I won't let it be.
So Margie, how did you come to be a follower of Jesus?
I think I came to be a follower of Jesus because my heritage was that. My parents really loved Jesus, and I have just such memories of my parents' love. My mum kneeling down beside my bed at night praying with me, and my dad kneeling down in the morning as he was getting ready for work, kneeling at an old camphor wood chest that was in his bedroom. And that's where he talked to God in the morning. I often tried to disturb his getting ready for work. I remember that. But he was such a faithful man of God. And when I was five, we moved churches to Valley Road Baptist. We had no transport, so we used a tram to get there. And my earliest actual memory of being in Valley Road was lying in Sunday school. I wanted to sit on the birthday chair. And it was not my birthday. And the teachers told me it was not my birthday. But I was determined to sit on that chair, and I won. And after Sunday school, they gave me at that time a card with a verse on it and a bowl of yellow roses. I would have been five. And my father was teaching bigger kids. And so I had to get rid of that card, or he would have said, "Why did you have it?" So I dropped it. And another girl who I remember to this day, Carol Turner, picked it up and said, "This is yours." And I said, "No, it's not." I was thoroughly convicted of my sinfulness that day. And I went, yes. So that's an early memory. Let me jump lots of years to my first Easter camp from Valley Road Baptist. I was 12. I was just in my first year at high school. And I knew clearly that God was asking me to serve him anywhere in the world that he wanted me to be. And that was a serious, even though I was only 12, that was a very serious decision. Let me jump forward to youth group, and I'm 17 probably. And someone had either not driven me home or had ignored me all night or something, but I was heartbroken by some boy, and I'm not even sure what boy it was now, but I was heartbroken. And I knelt down, my mum and dad were not home, and I knelt down by my bed I really can remember this and told my Heavenly Father how sad I was. And I heard an audible voice. That's all I can say. And that voice said, "Never mind. One day I will have someone much more worthy of you." The fact that it took 23 years for that to happen didn't honestly matter, but God had said it, and I knew it was true. So those are experiences of how growing up in a church that I loved, it was like my family, affected my life.
So you talk a lot, and Margie's actually written a book about, remind me of the title again? It's Lingering Over Letters?
Lingering Over Letters, yes.
And there's a copy of that's going to be in the church library probably in the next couple of weeks or so. I'd recommend it to everyone here to have a read of it. You talk in there very specifically about Valley Road Baptist as being just such a positive and formational kind of force for you growing up.
Yes, it certainly was.
Mm. Yeah. Reflections on the life of the church through that? What was special about it?
Well, it was a church that was deeply involved in mission. We had the principal of what is now Laidlaw College, which then was the Bible Training Institute. He was part of the church. And there were a lot of folk overseas in mission. Missions were part of my life from my earliest childhood. I remember photos of how people looked at that stage of my life. And of course, people came back and preached when they were home, and that was an important part of life too.
Mm. And in your book, you talk a little bit about how once you hit your 20s, you felt like there was two possible avenues for you. One of them was to get married, and the other one was to go to Bible college.
Yep. Now,
why marriage or Bible college? What?
That question, when you wrote that to me, that question troubled me in a way, and I've had to really do some analysis of this. I've told you about the promise there was of marriage, but honestly, I wanted God to bring into my life the person he wanted me to marry. Most girls of my age married. Remember, I'm in my upper 70s now. Most girls married in their early 20s. This was before contraception. People got married young, and that was good in my book. But I wasn't married young. I wanted a half a dozen kids. I was born an only child, and I wanted lots of children. But if God hadn't brought the person I was to marry into my life when I was in my early 20s, then I considered he must have another plan for me. And back in my day, people were not married. This is all to do. I've had to analyse this carefully. It's all to do with when you got married, you had a baby very quickly. And so the wife couldn't go on studying. So we had virtually no married people when I went to do my Bible training. Even ministers like Tim would have had to wait till they finished their training. They might be engaged for 4 or 5 years, as people in my youth were, but not allowed to get married because your study came first and you got that over and done with. Mm. So that's how that came about.
Yeah, you got to be pretty certain of God's call for a 5-year wait, don't you?
You do.
Thankfully, yes. That's not the case anymore.
Mm. Yeah.
So then at the age of 27, you find yourself heading off to Pakistan.
And I can tell you how that happened very easily, but it was a long process. As a probably an 17, 18-year-old. By the way, I started work as a 16-year-old, having got university entrance and been told by the careers people, my parents told, she's not university material. So my parents said, you're not going back to school for the honour and glory of being a prefect. You can get out and get a job, which was so easy in the 1950s. So I had this job, and I used to go along to a group called Christian Business Girls, walk there in my lunch hour. And I heard a woman speak there who said, there's little value in saying, God bless missionaries. Remember, I had offered myself as a 12-year-old to say I would serve God anywhere. She said, you ought to, not just me, people ought to get to know people in mission. Learn about the countries they work in. Really pray for them. Support them with your money. Well, very soon after hearing that woman speak, another woman came to that group called Kathleen Nichols. And she was a woman I felt I could really get to know and be interested in. She worked for an agency that had been for 100 years a women's mission to the women of India, undivided India. It had gone into the homes and it done education for women, and it had brought doctors to India to minister to women. And this whole organisation really appealed to me. By the stage that I was young, it had men as well, and that was good. But it was that organisation that I felt I could happily serve with. And I'd several times in my life and thought of training in domestic science, because that always cooking and homemaking had appealed to me. And when I had asked the mission about that, they had said I would be much more used to them in secretarial work. So off I went to Pakistan at 27 to an absolutely idyllic situation for a young single woman. I went to a university college for women to be PA to the principal, and it was just bliss as far as I was concerned. At that stage, only 450 young women, and I lived amongst them, lived with them, looked after one of their hostels, as well as being PA to the principal. Fabulous campus, great, great joy.
And also not without hardship for you personally in terms of just missing home and the distance and learning about a new culture and all of that stuff at 27?
Yes. I'd never lived away from my parents for more than 3 weeks in my life when I went for a four-year term. That was desperately hard, with no phone calls, no, just letters, just snail mail letters. And it's from those letters that I was able to write the book, really.
So you ended up getting evacuated from Pakistan, was that right? Was it?
No, well,
you were told that you needed to leave because of unrest at that point.
No, that's later. That's Afghanistan. I don't think.
I'm sure it was the first. When you were saying,
yes, I've been evacuated so many times. Yeah. yes. That's quite right, Tim, I'm sorry. War between when Bangladesh was formed, when Bangladesh had been East Pakistan, East and West Pakistan and India, and when Bangladesh was being formed, there was real fighting between India and Pakistan. And Lahore, where I lived and worked, was only 16 miles from the Indian border. So the planes were over and strafing before the sirens would go. And in the end, the British embassy who I was under, because New Zealand didn't have an embassy in Pakistan, said that they wanted us to go. And because I was an only child and I felt a huge responsibility to my mum and dad, because it was so hard on them having me on the other side of the world, I decided that, yes, it was the right thing to do, to evacuate and come home to New Zealand. And that was very healing, actually, because I was not nearly so homesick when I went back after that.
I just had a good question that was going to jump off that wasn't actually on the list. And it's totally gone from my head. Oh, no, that's right. I was just going to say, what was the biggest thing that God was teaching you in and through that time at 27, heading off from home like that? I mean, that's a remarkable step of faithfulness, really, isn't it? I mean, to do that.
And he was utterly faithful. Honestly, I now live as an older person without any blood family. But I am rich, hugely rich, in loving relationships. And Pakistan taught me that you don't have to be blood-related to people to be truly part of their lives and part of their family life. And I think that would be the biggest thing I learnt in those Pakistan years. They were precious, rich years, and still people from those years are part of my life.
Mm. So fast forward a number of years, really, and eventually God is faithful in answering that prayer to provide a husband. You want to tell us a little bit about Keith?
Keith was an outstanding man of God. And I think there are three things I want to say about Keith, my life with Keith. He had not had very much education. He had had to leave school because of the Depression at 13. He had had 1 year of high school and no further formal education. But he had blessed so many people in Papua New Guinea, not Fiji.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
That's all right.
Sorry.
Yep. That's all right. You might remember that Tim said at the very beginning of this that I'd lived and worked in Fiji as well. I hadn't. I had gone to Papua New Guinea with Keith. Keith spent 38 years of his life in Papua New Guinea in absolute remote conditions, like I'd never come across in Pakistan. And he took me there for 3 months. I loved it by day, I loathed it by night because of the rats and because of the bats in the walls of behind my bed. It was primitive in the extreme, but again with people that really were, the relationships there were rich. So Keith was a man of God. The second thing was that he loved me in such an unconditional way. It taught me more about God's unconditional love, my years with Keith, because he didn't have to love me. He chose to love me. And God chose to love me. And so, yes, it was very, very rich, my years with Keith. And then after 7 years of marriage, Keith died with cancer. And that also taught me that in God, love does not diminish because of death. That's something huge to know. Death is not the end of life for us who love Jesus. There's so much more to life than death.
Mm. Preacher, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. Precious.
Yeah. Mm. And from there, you ended up going back to Asia. Pakistan and Afghanistan sort of flitting across the border because it was quite a tumultuous period of history. This is like early 90s.
95 I left, yes.
Yeah. Mm. So what was going on in that part of the world at the time?
Well, Afghanistan had been invaded by the Russians in 1979, and they were there till 89. And then the tribal groupings within Afghanistan, tribal loyalties, had started fighting amongst each other. And Afghanistan was totally destroyed in the years between 89 and 95. Hmm. And the need was for someone to go in and do pastoral care of people that were working there. I mean, people had seen, they'd been stuck in basements of houses for 6 weeks at a time without being able to really surface for any sort of life. And there'd been home invasions, there'd been attacks on people. And the people that worked there, mainly in eye care, this sort of eyes, had been working there since the mid-1960s. And the need was great. The work that I went to join was headed up by a New Zealander, Bruce Gibbs, who had a history in education amongst the blind, and that's how he came to be chosen. And it was he who came and said, would you like to come and help us? Now, I must say that God's word had really spoken to me twice, many times in my life, but twice about location. And the first time was telling me that I was definitely to stay in New Zealand. This is after Pakistan, before I married Keith. After Pakistan, God had said to me through a story at the end of Jeremiah, if you will remain in this land, I'll plant you and not pluck you up. But if you insist for those people on going to Egypt, all the things you are fearing will happen to you there. Never heard anybody preach on it, but it's a very powerful story.
Challenge accepted.
Yeah. So I knew without a shadow of doubt that I had to stay in New Zealand. And those words were spoken to the remnant of God's people who hadn't been taken into captivity. Now, come 1995, and Keith has died about 5 years before, and I'm still deeply involved in mission. At that point, it was Chinese new immigrants in Auckland who were living in Glenfield. And I read on a Sunday morning in my quiet time, verses in Isaiah, where God said that people were to deepen their roots and put out new shoots. And I thought, that's lovely, that's what I want to do. But as I pondered that, I looked at the next verse and it said, a remnant will go out from Jerusalem. And I thought, oh, that's weird, because the remnant had been told to stay there. And now the remnant were told to go out. It just touched my heart. And I started to say to people, I wonder if God is asking me to go out again from New Zealand. And everybody's answer was monotonous. Oh, we wondered when it would happen. So when Bruce Gibbs approached me about going to Afghanistan, I felt, yes, this will be right. I will delight to go. I'd been there on holiday a couple of times back in 69 and 72, and it was a wonderful place. So I had no fear of Afghanistan when I went there.
Mm. And yet the the context that you find yourself in is kind of isn't the beautiful Afghanistan. It's
certainly
Afghanistan.
Certainly not. Yeah. Certainly not.
You talk about in your book. You talk about tanks on the street. You talk about bodies. You talk about being in your house. I think you're cooking and RPG into the roof one evening. You talk about being in the basement for long periods of time while shelling is going on. I mean, this is real courageous kind of stuff sticking in there, isn't it?
Yeah. But God's world was not in chaos. Look, I sat outside one morning with morning glory, purple morning glory climbing over the fence and noise of bombs around. And I thought, this is man's world that's chaos. Hmm. God's world is not in chaos.
Hmm.
And as long as I can keep my heart there, I felt safe. I mean that with all my heart. All right, it's God that gives the strength to feel like that, but that is honestly how I felt. I always believed that I was his child, that he would keep me safe as long as he wanted me to stay in the world. Since I have been back here, six of my own colleagues, people who were I cared for pastorally, have given their lives in that land.
Mm.
Six. And many, many more precious local people, yes. So God doesn't always keep us safe. I'd be the last to say that. But he does until his time for us is done.
Mm. Do you want to just elaborate a little bit on that? God's world isn't in chaos, man's world is. Like, how do you... Having experienced that stuff personally, I mean, we see those things going on all around us on the news. If we've got eyes to see, there's heartbreaking stuff going on all the time. Like, how do we make sense of that?
I guess I mean, when I say that, I mean, if you look at the sun coming up each morning, the moon coming out at night, crops still growing, they all talk of a God who still rules this world.
Hmm.
The chaos within the world is caused by people, not by God.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Hmm. I'm conscious of the passage of time and really wanting there to be opportunity for people here to engage a little bit. So if you're thinking of things that you'd like to ask Margie, then hold on to that. I've just got a couple more questions, though, just in the interim. Where you find yourself now, you're kind of in, I'll be polite, in later life.
Old age.
Old age. You said it. I didn't say it.
I said it.
One of the things that I'm not qualified to talk about it at all, being where I am right now, is retirement. And yet it's something I've heard you talk a little bit about retirement. And it strikes me, if there's one thing to be said about you in this stage of life, it's this kind of idea that retirement just doesn't seem to exist for you. You've kind of just... You're not just sitting back and resting on your laurels. You've lived a full life. You've done a lot of amazing things. You've been faithful to God the whole way through, and yet here we still find you're serving on the eldership. You're constantly saying things which freak me out, challenges and calls to faith which make me feel uncomfortable, and I'm thinking, aren't you just supposed to be chilling out now, Margie, just, you know, taking a break? Tell me about retirement.
Well, for me, I think I live in a retirement village. So I do see that people have to retire. I see people moving from their motor car to their mobility scooter to their Zimmer frame constantly.
Mm.
But God hasn't let that happen to me, and it hasn't happened to a lot of people in their 70s. And so while I've got a healthy body and I hope a healthy mind, although some of you will know I forget at times. I forgot home group this week, just completely forgot that there was home group this week. I believe I've got a responsibility to keep using what I've got. And I can't tell you the fulfillment that I've got at the moment in being totally able to be involved in Afghan culture again. Because God, in his wisdom, is bringing a large group of Afghan refugee women and their families to this city. And there's just such a wonderful open door, partly because I've got some language. And so when you're in an alien situation, someone that speaks a little bit of your tongue is precious. All of us would know that if we've travelled abroad. So, you know, it's just very exciting to be so involved here in Palmerston.
So that's through refugee resettlement you're
engaged in? Yes, it is through Red Cross. A friend of mine a few years ago said to me, Margie, it's a no-brainer to me that Red Cross are bringing in all these Afghan folk and you're not involved. And so I signed up with Red Cross, and Red Cross are very much part of my life now, both the retail shop and the way they funnel me into the Afghan community.
And you've had this another answer to that prayer, I guess, in, on your heart of wanting to have a big family one day. You've made yourself a family through your availability to people and just your willingness to invite people into your home and be part of your life, isn't that right?
That's right. The reason I chose Palmy when I came from Afghanistan, I'd never lived here before, knew very little about living here, but the reason I came was Catherine and Tim Linton. Catherine had boarded with Keith and I as a young new Christian. She'd needed a home, and Keith and I had poured ourselves into Catherine, and I believe in adoption. Absolutely, I believe in adoption. So they were here. They had three little boys under two. And I said to them in the year 2000, shall I come and help you with the kids when I retire? And they said, yes, please do. So it was became a settled thing that I would come and help with that family. The amazing thing is that by the time I came, they had more children, and there are six now. So I've got my big family.
And not only that, you've got, it'd be rare that I would have a conversation with you and you won't have somebody staying with you from somewhere, a university student or your home group, which you fully just embraced that idea and ran with it. And how many people do you have?
There's 15, if I'm included, and because someone who's present here this morning is sick, it allowed me to take in someone else. So, you know, we can't physically take in more into that group. I hope next year to split it in two and be able to take more people. It is part of my life, totally, every Monday.
Every Monday you're cooking for 15 people, aren't you? Yeah. Mm. Yep, 15 people who didn't necessarily have anywhere else to go on a Monday night, and you just bring them round. And
the only criteria about the people that come is that they live alone in all sorts of different situations. But we have become like family to each other in the last couple of years, I think.
Yeah. Well, I want you guys to have an opportunity to respond. And so maybe just with the people around you, turn around and just have a quick chat. What are the things that struck you about Margie's story? What are the things that challenged you? And what would you like to hear a little bit more from her about? So just a couple of minutes to do that.
Hi, Margie. The question I have for you is about when you were a young adult. I was wondering how you kind of coped with some of the social pressures around people around you getting married and maybe that waiting period before you actually got married.
I was so sure of God having spoken to me, one day I have someone much more worthy of you. Honestly, that was higher than most other things. Now, in my Pakistan years, the girls my hostel girls and other students would say, "Miss, why aren't you married?" And I sometimes said, well, in my culture, my parents don't make an arrangement for me. Like, because in Pakistan and Afghanistan, marriages were and still are usually arranged. But every time I said that to a student, I felt a wee bit guilty. Because while it was true, it wasn't true. God hadn't brought the... It was my certainty of God's care for me, really, that kept me, I think, through those years.
Margie, you're amazing. Susan and I were just saying, you know, we could listen to you all day long because you have this just this overwhelming presence of God in your life. And I just think that's amazing. I know for myself, from time to time, things haven't gone my way and I've sort of thrown a little pity party or, you know, got really down on myself and gone, you know, why me? This doesn't sound like that takes place in your life in terms of, you know, you didn't have any children of your own, you got married late and then unfortunately your husband passed away. Have there ever been times where you've actually gone, why God me? Or
No, I honestly don't think I have. The other thing is that somehow in God's economy, the path down is up. It's the way the master went, should not the servant tread it still. That's an old, old hymn. I honestly don't know. I know as a young woman, we had great discussions over have we no rights? And I think I'm so aware that God's plan is best. Yeah. And I think something I wrote down that I haven't said, but I think it's just a steady path of obedience in the same direction, knowing that God's glory is our ultimate end. Mm. Can I go?
No. So at early time in your life, you really sensed God's call or God's presence, and that's taken you on an amazing journey throughout the world and meeting all these people. Looking, being overseas and seeing different cultures at work, and then coming back into New Zealand, what advice would you give us who've just lived in this bowl as people trying to be Christians in this world? What sort of advice would you give us? Because I think we live in a very self-absorbent way.
I remember, Bill, as a young woman, that sort of thing when people would come from other countries and say, you don't know how fortunate you are to live here. You don't know. And I used to get very angry with such comments from people coming from other places, missionaries usually, because I'd think, I didn't ask to be born here. I didn't ask to be born into the privileged life I've got. So why do you tell me that I should be more grateful than I am? And I think until you are privileged to go out of your culture and actually immerse yourself somewhere else where that is what makes you grateful and why I can't live. Yesterday, I think I shocked the woman I was with, a woman from here who are here now, because I said to them, oh, I have a shower every week. And I saw them look at me. I wash myself, but there is no need, as far as I'm concerned, to waste water every day on washing my whole body. All right, I might be odd, but I have lived in places where water is a privilege and where everything is a privilege. I've got my friend Arizu with me this morning. Arizu is from Afghanistan. She's one of my new refugees who I love very dearly. And Arizu broke her hand a few weeks ago playing volleyball on a Thursday night in our hall. She didn't get knocked over. She just hit the ball and her hand broke. That is because she has come from a country where milk, even in tea, is not heard of because milk is a luxury. We don't realise the luxury we live in. And here I am doing just what I hated when I was young.
So let's just look at us, here in New Zealand. What is our main problem? I mean, we have become, I speak for myself, become so introverted in looking at me and what I should have or what I should deserve, which I think is the culture of our age. Is that our greatest enemy? And if that is, what, from your perspective, how do we look out and look back to God?
I wonder if we ever can until God judges us for our extravagance and our wants. Staying here, I don't know whether it's possible to change. We can take steps. We can live more sacrificially. I heard someone say that they were going to put 10 cents every time they drank a cup of tea or coffee into the fund for the Sudan, which is in a desperate state. We can do little things like that to incrementally take away from our self-absorption.
Margie, how did you get so wise?
I think God's the foundation of all wisdom. Yeah.
Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for Margie. Thank you for her story of faithfulness to you over the course of a lifetime. Thank you for her wisdom. Thank you for the courage, the inspiration. Thank you for the challenge that has come through her words this morning. Thank you for the amazing privilege it is to have her as part of our community here. We just ask that those things that she has spoken of this morning would just stay with us through this week, that we would carry them with us as we go from here. And Father, that we would be impacted to be people of equal faithfulness, those who would just simply hold out our lives to you and to ask you to take us and do with us what you will. And we ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.